Here and now, in a moment, our conversation about pigeons, heroes during World War II, inspiration for Darwin, the original GPS system. But first, the six Muslim men accused of plotting to kill U.S. soldiers at Fort Dix in New Jersey had a bail hearing this morning, as more is becoming known about them. They're all in their 20s. They'd lived in New Jersey outside Philadelphia, all foreign-born. Three came with their families as illegal immigrants to the U.S. Most went to high school together. One drove a cab and dropped out of community college to help pay his family's mortgages. Another worked at a 7-Eleven and delivered pizzas for his family's restaurant until he had a falling out with his father over religion. One has five kids, another twins on the way. But the FBI says there are recordings of them promising to wage jihad against U.S. military made with the help of paid informants. And the FBI also says the alleged ringleader, Jordanian-born Mohammed Schnur, brought one of the informants on surveillance trips before being arrested this week trying to buy assault weapons. Joining us on the line, Josh Meyer, who covers terrorism and national security issues for the Los Angeles Times. Josh, you've covered a lot of cases. How does this one strike you?
This is fairly unusual in the amount of evidence that they say they've gathered against the men. There was an FBI informant, two of them actually, but one in particular, who was with the men for about 16 months. And according to a 26-page affidavit and complaint, they said that they gathered a tremendous amount of information about how the men were discussing plots, how they were doing surveillance, how they were training with automatic weapons and so forth. So it seems unusual in the amount of evidence they've gathered.
How often do terrorism cases use paid informants, and how likely is it that lawyers for the suspects will then use entrapment as a defense?
Well, I've already spoken with one of the defense lawyers, and he said that it's too early to tell right now, but that he does see red flags that indicate that there could be some problems with this. For instance, in the affidavit by the FBI agent, he already said that one of the men had a problem with being less than truthful on one occasion, but the FBI, including J.P. Weiss, head of the FBI task force in southern New Jersey, told me that they were very, very careful about making sure that the men did not cross the line from being informants to actually entrapment or inciting the men, and that they worked with federal prosecutors to make sure that they didn't cross that line. The defense lawyers, however, say they are going to pursue potential entrapment issues and that there are some red flags. So it's happened in the past. There was another case in New Jersey, for instance, a terrorism case against a man named Mr. Lakhani, who they did use an entrapment defense. It didn't work, but they did try to use it.
Right. Any sense or any allegation today that this group of men was connected in any way to al-Qaeda or an existing terrorist organization?
No, I mean, they're emphatically saying that that was not the case, and they were not even connected to any kind of ethnic Albanian criminal organizations, which are somewhat prevalent around the world in very, very small numbers, I should stress. But they said that that was one of the benefits of having an informant on the inside, was that they were able to ascertain exactly who was involved in the plot, and they believe that the six men that have been charged are the only ones, and that there was nobody else in southern Jersey or in Philadelphia or in al-Qaeda that was connected.
Well, we are actually, though, hearing from terrorism experts, Steve Emerson among them, who are saying that that's what might make them more dangerous, and that there was no interceptable phone lines from overseas. These are people who sort of came out of nowhere.
Absolutely. I mean, that's, you know, J.P. Weiss, who is the head of the FBI in Philadelphia and the head of the task force in southern Jersey, said that that's the concern of law enforcement, is that these men have no identifiable, you know, criminal backgrounds or any other way to, you know, ascertain that they might be, militants, and that they could just come out of nowhere. And that's why it's important to have the public call authorities when they see something suspicious, and why it's also important to have informants on the inside.
Have you seen or heard any of what the prosecutors are saying is direct evidence against the men, videotapes made by them or the FBI recordings?
Oh, no. I mean, you know, the affidavit, though, it does have 25 pages. The affidavit and the complaint have 26 pages, I believe, of information about that. But no, the actual videotapes themselves are very tightly held. I suspect that wouldn't come up until trial.
Yeah. In February, the Justice Department Inspector General released a report concluding that the department inflated the number of terrorism cases it was prosecuting by routinely counting criminal cases. Do you get the sense, and this might just be a perception, that prosecutors are going out of their way to underscore that this, they believe, was a real terrorism case and not something less than that?
Oh, absolutely, Robin. I think that, you know, they were stung last summer when there was a case in Miami with a group of men that they now, you know, some federal officials admit were, you know, may not have been terrorists. I think they described them later as being more aspirational than operational, and that they sort of were just talking about committing acts. But, you know, according to the allegations and to the law enforcement officials involved in the case, they believe that these guys really were interested, willing, and able to launch an attack on a military base. So they say that this is a very serious was a very serious threat.
Josh Meyer, correspondent for the Los Angeles Times in Washington, who closely follows terrorism. Josh, thank you so much for speaking with us.
You're very welcome, Robin.
Well, on this Friday, we have a reflection on matters ornithological. We're referring, of course, to the pigeon, a bird a lot of people love to hate. Here's comic singer-songwriter Tom Lehrer on the subject.
All the world seems in tune on a spring afternoon when we're poisoning pigeons in the park. Every Sunday you'll see my sweetheart and me as we poison the pigeons in the park.
Tom Lehrer is not alone. There are people who hate pigeons. Woody Allen famously called them rats with wings, and that stuck. But did you know that the Holy Spirit visited the Virgin Mary in the form of a pigeon? That Darwin studied pigeons when he formulated his theory of evolution? Carrier pigeons saved thousands of lives during both world wars. One, Chère Amie, was awarded the French Croix de Guerre. Her stuffed and tattered body is on display at the Smithsonian. Pigeons mate for life, delivered the results of the first Olympics, brought news of Napoleon's defeat. A mere pound and a half of flesh and feather, they routinely fly over 500 miles in a single day, and scientists still don't know how they do it. Author Andrew Blechman spent a year with people who race pigeons, people who fly them, hunt them, eat them, frantically protect them. He shares what he found in the new book, Pigeons, the Fascinating Saga of the World's Most Revered and Reviled Bird, and joins us with more. Who knew? And welcome.
Thank you very much. I certainly didn't know.
No, you didn't. At the outset, you were sort of, well, what is this thing called a pigeon? And then we go with you on this journey. Why did you go on the journey? Why pigeons?
I tell people, I start with a tuna sandwich. Honestly, okay. I was at a bodega ordering a tuna sandwich, and this guy told me about his pigeons, about his brother, his and his brother's pigeons. And he started telling me that they race. And I was like, race? I go, you talking about the pigeons in the park? He goes, well, my pigeons are thoroughbreds. I mean, come on, we're talking about a pigeon here. So the next day I went out to see his birds, and you should have seen them running around their roof like they were soccer coaches in athletic costumes with whistles around their necks, like barking orders at their birds, brewing concoctions, special teas with different Chinese herbs in them, measuring out how many carbs to proteins they're going to eat that night.
This is Orlando and his friend Chester. Through them, you learn of these clubs where people pit their pigeons against each other in these races and love their pigeons. I want you to share a little with us of a scene where you are on the roof. Throughout the book, Orlando and Chester and others are preparing for this big race, the main event. But this is one point where you're up on the roof with them, and their birds, I think at this point, have been sent out?
Yes, 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 the night before. Okay. And now they're waiting for them to come back. Okay. This is the moment of truth.
Okay.
The waiting is killing Chester. He walks around the roof and talks excitedly about the sport. It's like a bug inside you, and you can't get it out. You got to be dedicated. I don't eat until my birds eat. I feed them a lot of carbs last night. Chester pauses mid-sentence and points at a black dot 50 yards away. There she is, he shouts. My bird, I knew it, I knew it. After navigating 500 miles home, the bird looks skinny and exhausted, as if she had lost some of her breast meat. Her mouth is open, gasping for water and air. But she's reluctant to enter the loft where Chester can grab her race band and timestamp it with the clock. She sits on top of the coop, staring warily at the man with the giant fly swatters. 5 precious minutes pass before she finally hits the landing board and enters the coop.
Now, animal activists make an appearance throughout your book for different reasons that we'll discuss.
The pro-pigeon underground.
They are, and there are people who, you know, are very much against this pigeon racing.
Yeah, there are some, but let me make clear, I'm not a bird person. You know, I just learned about, like, the birds in my backyard while writing this book, so I started to take an interest all of a sudden.
And what you got to know as you knew people like Orlando and Chester racing the pigeons is that these are, you know, tough guys living in Brooklyn, I think it was, but they loved their pigeons.
You know, I always think of Mike Tyson when I think of these guys. Mike Tyson is obviously a very tough guy. He came from a brutal neighborhood. And for him, the only sense of freedom or liberation he had was to go on his roof and let his pigeons out. And the best part, unlike everyone else in his life, they always returned. And they didn't want anything from him.
Let's talk a little bit about pigeons. When you're talking about pigeons, is the word interchangeable with doves?
It is, actually. Pigeon, basically, what is a pigeon? A pigeon is a dove. Pigeon is just pigeon. It's French for dove. And actually, when Picasso was painting doves, he was actually painting pigeons. His father was a pigeon fancier, and he named his daughter Paloma, which is just Spanish for pigeon, which is French for dove.
And you went to a show where people were purchasing pigeons, and they have curlicues, and there are pigeons that do somersaults constantly. There's a million different kinds.
I went to a pigeon beauty pageant.
That's what it was, actually.
Oh. And it was certainly unusual. There are hundreds of breeds of pigeons, but they're all the same bird. In fact, that's why Darwin used them to prove a theory of evolution. On the Origin of Species, the first 60 pages is nothing but pigeons. Mm-hmm. In fact, when he turned in his book to his publisher said, you know, nice book, but what do you say we just lose everything but the pigeon chapter and we'll just expand on that?
You went to some sort of an awards dinner in London.
Yes, for pigeons, for veteran pigeons.
An award dinner for veteran pigeons. And, you know, a veteran got up and spoke of a pigeon who had saved his life.
And there were tears.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, for example, Cher and Me, it's the story of the Lost Battalion. It was World War One. It was all of our boys stuck behind enemy lines. And they were being decimated not only by the Germans, but also by our own artillery, friendly fire. They had no way to communicate to headquarters. They had three birds. They would take birds in baskets with them into the trenches. And the first two were shot down with messages. They had one bird. We're talking about 500 men, our boys. Their lives were dependent on 1 pound of flesh and feathers getting a message back to headquarters to please rescue them. And this bird, Cher and Me, was actually shot at and gassed. It flew through a barrage of fire and actually plummeted to earth. And somehow, pluck, valor, what have you, was able to flap its wings again, gain some altitude, and get out of gunshot range. 25 minutes later, it landed at headquarters. It was missing an eye. Its breastbone had been ripped open. Mm-hmm. And the message was dangling from tendons. That was what was left of his leg. And those boys were saved. And I'm telling you, if this were Iraq, if those were your kids, I think you'd think that bird was pretty special.
Right.
And that bird actually received medals from the French, from the British, and from the Americans. And we're talking serious medals. Not only that, but it was brought back to the United States on a troop carrier and was given General Pershing's personal berth. And then arrived, and then it was received a hero's welcome. Yeah. Now, look how far we've come.
Yes, to many, the pigeon is now the bird that, frankly, poops on your car. Well, when we come back, the downside of being a pigeon, people shoot them, eat them, falsely think they spread disease. Andrew Bleckman's book is Pigeons, the Fascinating Saga of the World's Most Revered and Reviled Bird. We'll have more. And later in the program, we'll meet a law professor who says that Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez should be impeached for committing amnesia. That's coming later as well. Back after a quick break, Here and Now. Now, and we're back with more from author Andrew Bleckman on pigeons, the much-loved and sometimes reviled bird. Andrew, before the break, we were speaking of pigeons as heroic messengers, you know, all the tributes they received. But you also spoke to people who shoot them, eat them. You met pigeon shooters in Pennsylvania. Now, we need to warn fellow animal lovers that some of what we're going to talk about is upsetting, but I wondered, is it legal to conduct a live pigeon shoot?
Let me make this very clear to all your listeners. Unfortunately, it is legal to shoot thousands of live pigeons for target practice.
Explain how it works. It's very secretive. It was very difficult for you to get into one of these.
I think I'm the only person that ever has.
Well, and how does it work?
Basically, there's 5 baskets or so. Actually, maybe there's 9. And you don't know which one's going to open. And then a bird just catapults out, and you have to target it. There were so many things about it that were just so tragic. If you shoot the bird, but it lands outside of a prescribed circle, it doesn't count. The point doesn't count.
So but it's a dead bird. But
or actually, the Humane Society actually did a study on it. 75% of them actually don't die right away, but they suffer for either hours on end, or they have trapper boys, which are like 8 to 12-year-olds, who run out there, pick up the birds in between shootings, and then twist their necks or throw them in. They generally stuff them into trash bags where they all suffocate together.
Well, as you write, thankfully, a lot of these live pigeon shoots have converted to clay pigeon shoots. But you tried it and were slightly ashamed of yourself, not because you missed the pigeon, but because you got pulled in.
Yeah, I got pulled in. There's something very primal about holding a warm gun. I'm not a gun person. This was my first time shooting a shotgun.
Right.
And the competitive spirit overtook me, and then I was shocked by it. And then I was actually revulsed afterwards as I walked back to my car, and there were skewered pigeons all over the place, just like limping on one foot, blood coming out of their beaks, wings askew, and we're talking thousands of pigeons.
Okay. Well, and then you meet a whole underground of people, as you say, the pro-pigeon movement, people trying to protect pigeons, people sneaking around New York City. there's a pigeon internet chat site or something?
Oh, there's all sorts of pigeons. I mean, yeah, there's a listserv, and those are the rescue ones. And then there's the pro-pigeon underground. They all have code names. They keep you on camera, video camera, whenever you meet with them. And they run around trying to catch poachers on the streets of a lot of major cities who then bring them to rural gun clubs to shoot.
Another guy trying to protect the birds, David Roth of Arizona, who sort of lives in a bird cage. His whole house has this become a bird cage because he lets his rescued pigeons just wander freely and do what pigeons do. But he has saved pigeons from poisoning.
Dave Roth, I call him probably the sanest crazy person I've ever met. I found him utterly charming. He looks like Jerry Garcia, like circa 1972 from like the Europe 72 tour. And he seems awfully normal until you go into his house and it's covered in like a foot of guano.
Yeah, not good.
And pigeons attract an obsessive group of people.
Why do you think that is, though? What is it about the pigeon? It's not a crow. I mean,
it's the only animal I know that spans both sides of the spectrum. I mean, people love puppies and kitty cats, right? They don't like rats or snakes for the most part. But pigeons, it's like a foil on human nature. They either love them or they hate them.
But why the love?
Why the love? Because they're wonderful creatures.
Yeah. And they are loving.
Yeah, their biggest crime is that they're gregarious and they like us.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're incredibly gentle. I mean, what other creature would you let your 2-year-old romp around with?
Yeah.
You know, wildlife-wise.
Well, and having said that, and having met all these people who just have these, you know, passionate love, they just love their pigeons. You eat one.
Yeah.
What were you thinking? Well, because there are people who breed pigeons for eating.
Yeah, actually, pigeon is one of the finest meats in the world. I hate to compare it to this, but it's often referred to as a milk-fed feel of the sky. Basically, what we're talking about is squab. You would never, there's such a dislike of pigeons, a revulsion of them, that you would never see pigeon on the menu. Although in the colonial times, pigeon pot pie was one of the most popular things to make.
How they've survived all of this, I don't know, but keep going. Keep going. So you eat one.
So I do eat one. And unfortunately, this was right after a tour of a brutal slaughterhouse. And I was basically asked by a very hospitable, the owner who was giving me the whole tour, oh, have some. And it was the last thing I actually felt like doing at the time. But it was delicious. And I reached for another bite.
And for the second time, you're ashamed.
I want to say I'm ashamed. I want to say I'm ashamed of that one.
Well, because we have in the back of our mind Orlando and the pigeons that he loves, and Chester and the pigeons that they love. We're not going to give away the ending, but the main event, the big race, does happen at the ending. We've spoken about, you know, why people might love the pigeons, but why they hate them, you know,
yeah.
That they congregate in cities, that, you know, they do make a mess, they do what pigeons do. But is it true? I mean, are they flying rats? Do they spread disease?
No, and no.
I only asked two, but go
yeah,
ahead.
No yeah, and yeah. No.
Right, right.
No, they are not flying rats. The only thing they have in common with rats is they're both vertebrates. They don't carry any more diseases than you or I do. They're not particularly dirty. Don't forget, they live off the food we drop. They're basically our street cleaners. The reality is this. People don't have a problem with pigeons. They have a problem with too many pigeons. Mm-hmm. And wildlife, let's face it, wildlife is inconvenient. But does that mean that we have to poison it? It animates our lives. Our cities don't have much animation in that way, wildlife. All we really have are pigeons, squirrels, and sparrows.
And how do the carrier pigeons and the homing pigeons, how do they do that?
Well, the short answer is we don't know exactly. The long answer is it seems to be they have an internal compass that senses the Earth's magnetic field. And they have ultrasound hearing. They're able to hear wind over the Rockies from 2,000 miles away. Hmm. They're able to see ultraviolet light that gives them a sense of the curvature of the Earth. My favorite story is, you know, regardless of how they do it, they just do it. And my favorite story is Orlando, one of my characters. There's this race, and his best bird, Marty, is sent out. And Marty doesn't come home. It's a 300-mile race. Marty does not come home. And Orlando's, you know, it's one of his best birds. He figured, okay, a hawk ate her. Mm. Well, 2 weeks later, he's leaving his house. He's at the front door. He looks down at the stoop, and there's Marty with a broken wing. She had walked home.
Oh, you're killing me. You're killing me.
Who would have thunk? I'm telling you, they're wonderful creatures. I mean, they really are.
Andrew Bleckman's book is Pigeons, the Fascinating Saga of the World's Most Revered and Reviled Bird. It is a fascinating read. Andrew, thanks so much.
You're very welcome.
We had to. It's the Spinners, in honor of Marty the Pigeon. Still to come, a call to impeach Alberto Gonzalez. Back after the news, Here and Now. Support for Here and Now. Has Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez weathered the storm? That's the question after his two appearances before congressional committees investigating the firing of several U.S. attorneys. Gonzalez still has the support of President Bush, but our next guest argues that Gonzalez should be impeached. Frank Bowman is professor of law at the University of Missouri. He's a former federal prosecutor who worked in the U.S. Justice Department under both Democratic and Republican administrations. He called for the impeachment of Alberto Gonzalez in a recent op-ed in the New York Times. Professor Bowman says when Congress asked Gonzalez about the firings, the Attorney General responded with, quote, phony forgetfulness, essentially committed amnesia on behalf of the Bush administration. Well, Professor Bowman joins us. And Professor, first, remind us, what do you mean by impeachment?
The Constitution permits the removal of the president, the vice president, and all civil officers of the United States in Article 2. In order for someone to be impeached, that would require the House of Representatives to bring articles of impeachment, which essentially amount to something like an indictment or a set of charges. And if the House votes in to approve those articles, then the case goes over to the Senate. The Senate essentially convicts the person, though it's certainly not a criminal case. Then the officer is removed.
So we have been thinking of impeachment as a process of questioning. Are you not thinking that that's part of the process? Are you thinking purely of removal?
Well, impeachment under the Constitution means removal. But, of course, before one could get to the question of whether or not somebody should be removed, you have to ask questions of them, or at least ask questions about the circumstances that would lead to removal.
Right. Did you hear yesterday anything that changed your mind about this?
No. I think, unfortunately, the House hearing was not as useful in many ways as the Senate. I think that has to do in large measure with the fact that the House Judiciary Committee is a larger group. They have shorter periods of time to question. But neither do I think that Attorney General Gonzalez answered significant questions about the issues that he's being pressed on.
What's the main issue?
First is the question of whether or not Congress is entitled to, as I think it surely is, information from the executive branch about the decisions that it makes on important questions like the administration of the Department of Justice and the continued tenure of important officers of the department like United States attorneys. And the basis of the op-ed I wrote for the New York Times suggesting that impeachment was at least a possibility with respect to Attorney General Gonzalez was really that the Attorney General failed to answer candidly legitimate questions being put to him by Congress in the exercise of its oversight function.
Well, let's be clear, because you also write that constitutionally, Alberto Gonzalez, or any attorney general, has a right, for instance, to replace any U.S. attorney with a political crony, to replace a U.S. attorney if they don't pursue the president's opposing party aggressively, or if they pursue a president's party too aggressively. You're not arguing that any of those actions that some are accusing Alberto Gonzalez's department of doing are impeachable. So what exactly is it that you feel is?
During his Senate appearance, the Attorney General was not, in my view, candid. I think that view was obviously shared not only by Democratic senators but by Republican ones. And a failure to be candid under oath in front of the Senate or the House of Representatives is plainly an impeachable offense. But let's be clear also that while it may be within the president's power to remove a U.S. attorney for essentially political reasons, that doesn't make doing so an appropriate thing for an attorney general or the president to do. It may be within his power, but that doesn't make it right. And one of the things that I think is now becoming clearer with respect to Mr. Gonzalez and the administration is that despite their vigorous efforts to deny it, at least one and maybe more of these U.S. attorneys was removed for flagrantly political purposes. And it certainly appears removed because he failed to pursue cases that would benefit the Republican Party in a tight election. And while doing that may be within the constitutional power of the president, it's still a scandalous abuse of that power and one that we ought to be very concerned about and one which certainly impacts the fitness of the attorney general, this attorney general, to continue in office, particularly with respect to the case of David Iglesias, the U.S. attorney in New Mexico.
Are you saying that if Alberto Gonzalez had gotten on the stand in either of these hearings and said, you know, I was getting a lot of pressure, our department was getting a lot of pressure because the election was near and there was the thinking that charges of voter fraud weren't being pursued aggressively enough and it would be important in the upcoming election and the results of the upcoming election, so we wanted to have our people in there. If he had said that, which is what his critics are saying, you know, actually happened, would you then not have a case for impeachment? Because, again, you're saying that it's because he had selective amnesia.
I think that's a tough question. I think the strongest case, the easiest case for impeaching Mr. Gonzalez is based on the simple assertion that he lied under oath to Congress and that that's an impeachable offense, and everyone has historically recognized that it must be. When you add to that evidence that he has essentially acquiesced in turning the department into an instrument of partisan politics, I think that at a minimum strengthens the case for his removal. Because at the end of the day, there is no set definition of what an impeachable offense is.
But I'm saying if the lack of candor weren't there, as you said, the president does have the right to replace anyone who doesn't pursue administration priorities.
I think in an extreme case, it gets a little trickier. They certainly have the right to replace anybody who doesn't pursue administration priorities, yes. If it can be shown that they have retaliated against a United States attorney for refusing to bring non-meritorious cases, because that's essentially what I think has happened in Iglesias' case. Mm-hmm. There's no claim that the voter fraud cases that he refused to bring in New Mexico were meritorious. And when Gonzalez is pressed about why Iglesias is fired, he repeatedly says that he is fired in essence because he lost the confidence of the senior senator from his state. He's not being fired because he did anything wrong, because he brought cases he shouldn't have or didn't bring cases that were supported by the facts. Gonzalez is admitting that he was fired because he lost political support from a senator. And why did he lose support from that senator? He lost support from that senator because he'd essentially refused to bring cases that were damaging to Democrats and helpful to Republicans. Gonzalez has effectively admitted that Iglesias was fired for failing to use the prosecutorial powers of the United States Department of Justice to affect an election. So if you could show that you're retaliating against the U.S. attorney for refusing to bring cases that have no provable merit, and you're doing it because you're upset with him for failing to misuse his office to promote a partisan political agenda, that shades very closely into an impeachable offense by itself, I think.
Frank Bowman, former federal prosecutor who worked in the U.S. Justice Department, now professor of law at the University of Missouri. He says Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez should be impeached if he does not resign. Professor Bowman, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Still to come before we go, photographer Andre Serrano and thoughts on that brawl on the balcony at the Boston Pops. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, Well, the NBA playoffs are in full swing, as is Barry Bonds' bat as he chases the home run record, and baseball considers a ban on booze. Joining us for comments on these stories and more, Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. Always good to see you, Bill.
Hello, Robin.
And to start with the NBA playoffs, you know, Father's Day, we're up on Mother's Day, but let's just jump ahead to Father's Day because it's such a wonderful story. Utah Jazz point guard Derek Fisher, his 10-month-old daughter Tatum had a successful operation, the first of many, to cure a cancerous tumor in her eye. He missed game one of the Western Conference semifinals to be with her, flies back for game two, arrives in the third quarter to a standing ovation, causes a key turnover, but then there's more.
Then, having not shot a ball in 4 days, he sinks the clutch three-pointer in overtime to win the game. And then in a post-game interview, he urges parents to make sure their children are checked for possible eye diseases. So a child doing well after surgery trumps a clutch three-pointer in overtime, even in the playoffs,
right,
every time. But,
right,
yes, yeah, so far the story has happy ending.
A great story, and one people are following as they follow the playoffs. The Detroit Pistons on the verge of ousting the Chicago Bulls. Cleveland, backed by LeBron James, leads the Nets 2-0. And after pulling the biggest upset in recent memory by eliminating the Dallas Mavericks in round one, Golden State now trails Derek Fisher's Jazz 2-0. But is Golden State's golden run, though, near an end?
Yeah, almost certainly, I would think. But Golden State Warriors fans are a hardy lot, and they've watched an awful lot of bad basketball and bad drafts over the years. And this is a sort of the we're just happy to be here syndrome.
Right.
So they can build on this, as they say in sports circles.
Right. Well, so now to some of the darker news in sports. And it feels to me like, I don't know, we increasingly have these. You tell me. But in the wake of the death of St. Louis Cardinal pitcher Josh Hancock in that auto crash and, you know, his alcohol level nearly twice the legal limit, the Cardinals banned alcohol in their clubhouse. The Chicago Cubs followed, ending a team policy of providing alcohol in the clubhouse, barring it from the team plane, as did Baltimore. The league and the players' union are talking about, you know, these bans. What, if anything, would an all-out baseball alcohol ban accomplish?
Well, I'm not sure that it does anything more than public relations at this point. It's probably a good idea to bring this to the attention of the players, but if Josh Hancock's death didn't do that, I'm not quite sure what will. And, of course, Hancock wasn't drinking for hours in the clubhouse and then climbing into his car. He was drinking for hours in several different bars, and several different people commented on the fact that he could barely get a sentence out, and he got into his car and drove. This is obviously not something limited to baseball players, and it's a terrible, sad thing whenever it happens to anybody. Mm-hmm. And I guess anything that raises consciousness about this particular danger is a good thing.
Good thing. Well, San Francisco Giants slugger Barry Bonds, closer to passing the Hank Aaron all-time home run list honor. Red Sox pitcher Curt Schilling took a few swings at Bonds. He called him a steroid user, chastised him for cheating on the game, his taxes, his wife. And then Red Sox player David Ortiz came out in support of Bonds, and manager Terry Francona steps in, tells both players to cool it. Schilling issues an apology. And meanwhile, Bonds is making his way towards Boston, where maybe he'll make that... You know, make that
could happen anywhere. Hit. Some people think that that the record-breaking home run must occur in San Francisco because that's the only city in which people will appreciate it rather than turn their backs on the entire achievement. You know, it's very strange the way this has worked out. I hope that the result of Terry Francona's taking Schilling and Ortiz aside will be that players will think twice about commenting on things about which they aren't experts.
Well, then it does seem, too, as if Bonds has already succeeded in rattling other teams by getting them to get all flustered about this.
Well, he's been rattling other teams for about 25 years, so no problem there and no change. But, you know, there's so much to distract us from what goes on the field. I think the last thing we need is... And this isn't the first time for Curt Schilling. He's the guy who said, get out there and vote for the president. So.
Yes, he's very outspoken on his own blog.
Exactly.
And, you know, he's had to apologize several times before. Bill Littlefield covers sports and much more each week on NPR's Only a Game. Bill, thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
Still to come, the real origins of Mother's Day. That's here and now. And now, and our next story has some provocative language in it, and that's the point. You might remember photographer Andre Serrano's 1989 photo of a plastic crucifix in urine entitled Piss Christ, which became the symbol of the debate over artistic expression and religion. In fact, when Muslims protested those Danish cartoons depicting the Prophet Muhammad and people actually died in riots, the Chattanooga Free Press reached back to Serrano, saying, well, at least no one was killed over Piss Christ. Since then, Serrano has photographed Ku Klux Klan members, homeless people, corpses. But his recent work, including a series called America, looks a little more on the bright side. We've got pictures on our website, here-now.org. You might find some offensive, but we want to ask what he thinks. Welcome, Andre Serrano.
Thank you.
What do you think? Is that an appropriate characterization, that America is a little more on the bright side? Or?
Well, America, is, you know, they're portraits. And I find it ironic and somewhat hypocritical that the people who get most upset with my work, because it's so provocative at times, are very disappointed when it's not provocative. And, you know, no one ever gets upset with Richard Avedon or Annie Leibovitz or Cindy Sherman for only making portraits. Yeah, they're portraits, and I don't know if that means that they're on the bright side. They're just not provocative.
Right. I'm looking at some of them. There's Bell O'Nock, America's Best Clown. He's the guy with the hair that goes straight up, big grin, and it's just sheer happiness. Is that, though, what you intend there, or is there something else there, too?
Well, Bell O'Nock's portrait is a part of America, and America came out of September 11th, you know. A few days after the 11th, I said to a friend of mine, I'd like to enlist in the war effort as an artist. And so there was a reason then to create a body of work entitled America. It starts with the characters of September 11th, the Boy Scout representing a little soldier, an airline pilot, a man looking like Taliban. And then it goes into other facets of America. A lot of the portraits that I eventually put in America are of people laughing. In fact, there's one of my favorites is of Gisela Glaser, who's a Holocaust survivor from Auschwitz, 1945. She's laughing, you know, in the camera. And so documenting a moment in time, but expressing enthusiasm for life. You know, I was saying that no matter what happened, people would still laugh at it. They would laugh in the face of death and survive.
Do you see a certain irony in people who can afford it buying your work, photographs of the homeless, for instance, or Ku Klux Klan members, when they might not actually come in contact with those communities?
Sure. I saw that a long time ago, you know, as I started to make that work. In fact, I once said to a friend of mine, as I was making those images, I wondered whether or not anyone would be interested in buying pictures of the Klan or the homeless. And he said to me, you know, what you have to remember is they're not buying pictures of the Klan or homeless. They're collecting Serranos, meaning that the people who like your work and the people who will buy it because it's your work, not because of the subject matter necessarily.
Well, then is there something subversive about how you choose the subject matter to make them be confronted with something they don't want to see?
Absolutely. It does make the viewer and the collector push themselves to the point where they can see something or accept something that under normal circumstances would be unacceptable.
What would you say to people who assumed that the crucifix in urine was an anti-religious statement?
First of all, you know, I felt that that this criticism leveled at me of being of anti-Christian bigotry was what rang false, because I'm not anti-Christian. In fact, I am a Christian. And so as a Christian, as an artist, I feel I have all the right in the world to use the symbols of the church, because it's my faith. You know?
You collect symbolic furniture.
Iconography. Yeah, well, you know, I'm drawn to Christian and Catholic iconography in my life as a collector in my home. You know, and also as an artist. But you know, getting back to the Muslim.
The Muslim cartoons.
The cartoons, you know, when I heard about it, I said to a friend of mine, I had no interest in seeing them. And the difference is that the people who made them, the Danish cartoonists who made them, are not Muslims. And so that's the difference, you know. I'm a Christian, and so what I do is religious art. And someday my work, I hope, will be collected by the Vatican, because I've certainly shown in a number of churches in Europe who accept it as Christian iconography.
Really? You might expect even the crucifix in urine. You think that might be a Vatican collectible?
Yeah, I think so. I think the thing that upset people the most was the title. But it was just being direct and literal. After the hysteria, then a certain amount of intelligent awareness comes into play. If you look at the piss Christ, it's a way of humanizing religion, a way of personalizing it. And you know, bodily fluids, you know, you can't put, you know, a moral value on them. You can't say that blood is good, milk is good, and piss is bad. I mean, these are life's vital fluids, so they're all necessary.
Huh. Okay. Andre Serrano, and by the way, we have several of the pictures at our website, as I said, here-now.org. And I want to ask you one last thing, and I want to phrase it carefully because you're going to be with us a long time. You're incredibly vibrant. The energy you brought into this room is palpable. But when it does happen, and the New York Times writes your story in those back pages there, the headline is probably going to be, despite all the decades of photography since, the headline is probably going to be the controversial photographer of Piss Christ. Mm-hmm. That okay with you? Is that something you want to change between now and then when that time comes by doing something else?
Well, you know, I have new shows in mind, and they're going to be a little darker, which is what is expected of me. So I would hope that they would... you know, that would mean that I was a controversial artist, period, meaning that Piss Christ was just one of many controversial works that I created.
Or maybe there's another one that'll knock Piss Christ off the, off the headline.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, boy. We thank Andre Serrano and the Paula Cooper Gallery in New York for making images available. Again, they're at our website, here-now.org. Andres, thanks so much for speaking
with
us.
Thank you.
And a closing thought. To borrow a phrase from hockey, the other night I went to the Fight Center, concert broke out. Have you seen the video of what we here in Boston are calling Fight Night at the Pops? The pictures going round the world of two guys swinging at each other in the balcony at Symphony Hall do look kind of funny, but it was actually quite terrifying. Keith Lockhart and the full Pops Orchestra were in the middle of the Phantom of the Opera when they were interrupted by blood-curdling screams. Reportedly, a man was talking. Another told him to shush. The response, a punch to the face. Round one was underway. On the floor of the hall below, a collective gasp. Would they roll down over the railing? And then the unthinkable. The Boston Pops stopped, like a grand elephant slumping to its knees or a train coming to a screeching halt. I mention this because Mother's Day is coming. Yes, President Wilson declared the first official Mother's Day in 1914, but in 1870, Julia Ward Howe wrote a plea for peace after the Civil War. Her Mother's Day proclamation reads in part, "Arise, then, women of this day. Our husbands will not come to us reeking with carnage. Our sons will not be taken from us to unlearn all we have been able to teach them of mercy and patience. From the voice of a devastated earth, a voice goes up with our own. It says, disarm, disarm." So, to you brawlers in the balcony, listen to your mother. And to everyone else, have a peaceful Mother's Day. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us.